Robert E. Lee of the Confederacy. He was a big old army leader guy. Oh, Robert E. Lee of the Confederacy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Fighting the Union, fighting for the right to keep slaves. Fighting against the good old American way. Robert E. Lee, the marble man, fighting as hard as he can, trying to stop America from doing the right thing. Robert E. Lee, a terrible person, fighting for the right to keep people as slaves. Robert E. Lee, you big old idiot.
Thousands of enslaved men and women worked in Richmond factories, created wealth for slave owners and factory owners, but also created space and power and institutions despite being enslaved.
Our movement can't be simply an anti-racist movement, but really is a movement against oppression. And so while we want to clearly identify the centrality of racism in the current moment, we can't repeat the mistakes of the past of shoving these other issues under the table.
This week from the Race Capital podcast, Organizing Through the Divide, author and historian Peter Ratcliffe and longtime labor educator and organizer Bill Fletcher Jr. explain how the institutions of Richmond, Virginia have worked strategically to divide the movement, and how the Lee Monument represents a literal fight in the court and the current symbolic fight to defend black lives. We find out why the gigantic monument was proposed back in 1890, how the Working Men's Reform Party built the old Richmond City Hall on an eight-hour day, and that it was this labor organizing movement that brought the proposal to glorify a Confederate general and construct the Lost Cause narrative we're still dealing with today. And we learn about a third political party that organized through the National Knights of Labor, but was stopped in their tracks with the contract to build the statue of Robert E. Lee. And on this week's Labor History in 2, Rick Smith wishes us a happy Union-made Halloween. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. I hope you enjoy the show. Oh, and don't forget to vote.
You're listening to Race Capital on WRIR-LP 97.3 FM Richmond Independent Radio. This week on Race Capital, we're discussing organizing through the divide. I talked to Dr. Peter Ratcliffe, labor organizer Bill Fletcher, both about how the institutions of Richmond have worked strategically to divide the movement, and how the Lee Monument represents the literal fight in the court, but also the current symbolic fight to defend black lives on this land. We go back to why this gigantic monument was proposed in 1890. Our public memory can verbalize that it was to solidify the white race. But do you know the true context of the time? Have you learned about the Working Men's Reform Party that built the old city hall on an eight-hour day and met the demands of the multiracial labor organizing movement? Join us this week to learn and listen about this third political party that organized through the National Knights of Labor, but was stopped in their tracks with the contract to build the statue of Robert E. Lee. Thanks for tuning in to Raise Capital.
We're going to talk today a little bit about how the monument stopped the organizing and the progressive movement that was happening right after emancipation, after a historic build of the Richmond City Hall. This monument popped up. And then now in 2020, in October, just days before the election, what the national news is talking about with Richmond, Virginia, after months of protest, is still this monument. This week on Race Capital, we have Dr. Peter Radcliffe and Bill Fletcher Jr.
I'm Peter Radcliffe, and I wrote a book called Black Labor in Richmond, 1865 to 1890. The book grew out of my PhD dissertation, a project that I spent about a decade from the mid-70s into the early 80s working on as a graduate student at the University of Pittsburgh. I was drawn to the subject. I am not from Richmond. I was drawn to the subject largely because of my childhood and youth growing up in New London, Connecticut, a community that was very influenced by the U.S. Navy and manufacturing of submarine warships. And that work and the Navy brought significant numbers of African Americans and Puerto Ricans and Filipinos to New London. And so I was fortunate in the 1950s and 60s to go to public schools in which white students like me were a minority. And I learned a great deal. My first teachers were my fellow students who taught me about the struggles that they and their families were going through, and led me to ask a lot of questions about why was inequality so driven by race and why was inequality so present in the United States. I went off to college in 1969, asking questions influenced by the rise of the Black Panthers, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I was asking questions about whether the war in Vietnam was an accident, and asking questions about whether we had actually made progress on racism in the United States. And I like to say that I answered those questions in my first semester at college. And that led me to then ask for the next 3.5 years, and really for the rest of my life, given the answers to those questions, what was I going to do about it?
And really quickly, what year was it?
Sure. So it was the fall of 1969 and the winter and spring of 1970. It was the year of the murder of students at Jackson State in Mississippi and the murder of students by the National Guard at Kent State University in Ohio. It was also the year of the Black Panther trials in New Haven, Connecticut. And I was a very fortunate young man that I had a teacher at Amherst College named Jan Desard, who fortunately is still alive and someone I stay in touch with, such important mentor to me, that Jan had been an advisor to the defense team for Huey P. Newton in Oakland. He brought those experiences into the classroom at Amherst College, and that he drove a carload of students from Western Massachusetts to New Haven to participate in the protests during the trial of the Black Panthers. And every time in the rest of my life when I drove a carload of young people to a protest somewhere, I thought about Jan and his having driven me as a student. And so I think I became a dedicated mentor because I was shaped by dedicated mentors. And they really modeled for me that white people have to take responsibility for the racism and inequality that we see in our society. And because of the privileges and access to skills and resources that I had, I became an academic. I became a teacher. I became a scholar and a researcher. And I turned those skills to use in trying to understand the historical development, not only of racism, but also of the struggles against racism. And it's so important that we not lose the memory, lose track of those struggles in the past, because there's a hell of a fight. There was a fight in history, and then there is a fight about history. And if we cannot imagine that people fought back in the past, how can we imagine how we can fight back in the present?
There was a fight in history, and there's also a fight about history. That seems really deeply here in the fallen capital of the Confederacy.
Sure. Richmond was more than the capital of the Confederacy. That Richmond was the center of industrial slavery in the South. Thousands of enslaved men and women worked in Richmond factories, created wealth for slave owners and factory owners, but also created space and power and institutions, despite being enslaved, that they created space within which they could love each other, they could organize together, they could try to make their lives better, and they could keep an idea of freedom alive that would blossom during the Civil War, when Richmond became not only the capital of the Confederacy, but a center of the Underground Railroad, a place of resistance. And that in the aftermath of emancipation, that those enslaved people and the formerly free African Americans who had lived and worked in Richmond would together create a series of social movements, or as some of us would say today, a freedom movement that took different shapes at different times and carried those experiences and those relationships forward with them.
So what got you interested in Richmond specifically?
So there's the practicality of being a graduate student, and I had a teaching assistantship, and it was made clear to me that if I did not complete a master's thesis within 3 semesters, I would lose my funding. So I needed to have a project. I was making an intellectual transition from having been a sociology undergraduate student to being a history graduate student. So I didn't know a hell of a lot about history. And in the seminar for labor history students at the University of Pittsburgh in the fall of 1974, my second great mentor, David Montgomery, who taught at Pitt, David introduced me to a book called Industrial Slavery in the Old South by a young white scholar named Robert Starobin. And in Starobin's book, he spends a lot of time talking about Richmond, about the tobacco factories, the iron factories, the nail factories, the flour mills, and the presence of enslaved and free African Americans working in those factories. And so I had brought a primary interest in race and in the intersections of race and class, understanding how those dynamics worked together. And so when I read that book and then discovered that no one had really written about Richmond after 1865, that I decided I would zero in on Richmond, try to understand what happened when slavery ended. Did African Americans keep those jobs? Did they organize unions? What kinds of relationships did they have with white workers in those factories? Did they organize unions together? So those were the questions that brought me to look at it.
Were there any numbers that stood out to you that really said, I have to learn more about Richmond labor?
When I learned about the social institutions that enslaved people had helped to create, the First African Baptist Church in the early 1840s, mutual aid societies, burial societies, the ways that people work together to care for each other, to have each other's backs. The concept that I'm sure is bubbling up in Richmond in the last 6 months, the concept of mutual aid, and the discovery also within working class life in the United States of cooperation, of the ways that people care for each other rather than compete with each other. I was very interested in that fabric. And I discovered one of the great things that I came across were the records of the Freedmen's Savings Bank in Richmond. 7,000 African Americans opened accounts at the Freedmen Savings Bank. No one, and the ideology of the Freedmen Savings Bank was a benign white patriarchy was going to create an institution to teach freedmen and freedwomen the value of thrift. I discovered that during slavery, there were free African Americans who married enslaved African Americans and spent years earning and saving the money to buy their lovers' freedom. That there were enslaved African Americans who saved the money to buy their own freedom. And so no white people needed to teach them. And I found that the Black community in Richmond in the years after the Civil War practiced a kind of fictive kinship. There were created families that were intergenerational, ways that they took whatever resources they had and used them for the collective betterment of the community. And so unions and political organizations were extensions of this kind of mutuality and cooperation.
So when people hear that an enslaved person could save money to buy their own freedom, mm-hmm. could you actually break down what that would look like? Many folks would say they don't earn money. They're just working. What does that look like?
Starobin, in his book, Industrial Slavery in the Old South, points out that when it came to factory work, that enslaved people essentially negotiated that piecework bonuses. They would negotiate to earn a bonus if they exceeded the quotas that were sought. So the management in those factories learned that you had to use money as a way to motivate labor from enslaved people. Because the collective experience of labor, and we know that this went on in tobacco fields and cotton fields. If you read the great, relatively new book by Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told, which is about what happens in the cotton fields between 1800 and 1860, that there is resistance. One of the great issues in the fields was who was going to be the song leader? Because the enslaved workers wanted a song leader who would set a pace that even the oldest and the youngest could keep up with. The overseer wanted a song leader who would set a pace that would make workers work faster. Understanding class. There is always a struggle over the work itself, became a source of income and savings for enslaved people. Their owners were often on remote plantations outside of the city, and they were, in many cases, allowed to negotiate their own hiring arrangement. And because labor was so valuable to the iron mill and the tobacco factory and the flour mill, and those workers learned individually and also listened to each other how to negotiate, how to play the employers off against each other. And so that was embedded in the Black community.
Prior to
emancipation. In the spring of 1886, a labor organization that, unless you were a labor historian, you hadn't heard of, that called itself the Noble and Holy Order of the Knights of Labor, which was all over the United States in the 1880s, that the Noble and Holy Order of the Knights of Labor had been organizing in Richmond, had been organizing African-American workers as well as white workers. And in the spring of 1886, the Richmond City Council announced that it was time to build a new city hall, that the former city hall had been burned down when Jefferson Davis and the Confederates scurried out of town in April of 1865. Given the ideology of this new South, it was an embarrassment that the former capital of the Confederacy did not have an impressive city hall. And so finally, they decided they were going to build one. And the Knights of Labor organized and presented a petition signed by about 9,000 people to the city council saying, we too would like to see a new city hall built, but we have conditions. We would like it to be built out of local materials. We would like it to be built by local labor. We would like it to be built on the 8-hour day. We would like it to be built providing a living wage to workers. And the fifth condition, we would like, in the language of the day, colored workers to have access to skilled jobs on this project along with white workers. And when they presented that petition to the city council, responded with a discourse that I think we would be very familiar with today. They said, we would be fiscally irresponsible. We need to build a city hall as cheaply as possible. We want to put it out to bid and let contractors from all over the country make offers, and we'll take the lowest bid. And the Knights of Labor's local leaders, one, William Mullen, a white guy from the printing trades and the editor of a labor newspaper, the Richmond Labor Herald, and the other, Joseph Brown Johnson, an African-American barber, that the two of them came to the city council and said, if that's your decision, we're going to organize an independent political party that we're going to call the Working Men's Reform Party, and we're going to run for your seats. And lo and behold, in May of 1886, they succeeded and swept to control of the city council. They built the city hall, meeting all five of the conditions, and they built a beautiful building, which, as I'm fond of saying, does not have a plaque on it that tells the story of how this building came to be built. We met, we connected, Chelsea, you and I, because I wrote an article about how the Robert E. Lee Monument, the 50-foot-tall monstrosity, how that was constructed in order to pull apart the white workers who had been part of the Working Men's Reform Party and the Knights of Labor, and the African-American workers who had been part of it. It was part of a campaign to drive them apart.
And let me jump in and say that I want to give a shout out to Donald Miner, that a lot of us do know. He is a longtime labor organizer that is supportive of many of us in this movement and supports a lot of young folks. And he would be considered an elder. And so it is this intergenerational moment that we are all experiencing right now on this radio show podcast to be able to connect this moment in history through our elders in this community. So I just also wanted to give a shout out to Donald and all his work right here in the 6th District. We're district buddies. As
Donald and I are connected through his presence in the labor movement and his involvement with United Food and Commercial Workers Union. So it's so great that these connections get made.
But here we are in October, and the monument still stands. We still do not have a decision on this monument. And to even talk about the process of the city hall, of how it was built with care, it's also important to now talk about how this particular monument was put up as we work so hard to bring it.
I also want to add, Chelsea, that, and I often am unsure whether to use the word ironic or the word appropriate. But when I wrote my article about the statue, I sent it to the Richmond Times-Dispatch. They never even replied. I sent it to the Washington Post. They never even replied. And so I write an article about the suppression of history and my article. So finally, Yehuru Williams, who has written a great book on the Black Panthers, a great book on the history of the civil rights movement. Yehuru is at the University of St. Thomas here in St. Paul. Yehuru hooked me up with the Progressive magazine And they published it in a hot minute.
As somebody that was heavily inquired upon from media throughout the summer, everyone outside of Richmond only wanted to talk about these monuments. So it's really interesting that you tell me that it's also a certain part of the monument they wanted to talk about, which was the current day and what would happen in the future, not necessarily the past of how we got here.
Or that this is a Confederate monument and that white people in the South are hopeless. And so, of course, white people in the South put up a Confederate monument years after Robert E. Lee died. They just can't help themselves. And in fact, what I know, and part of what I'm trying to draw a historical thread to, is that there have always been race traitors among white people. And if we do not breathe on those embers, we are not going to build movements that can be powerful enough to change the world in which we live.
Thank you for saying the word race traitor.
But it's important for white people to see role models in the past. And the Richmond story is also a story of ultimate failure. And it's important for us to understand why, though the movement could win that election in 1886 and build that city hall the way they had wanted to build it, that there were ways that people within that movement were still vulnerable to the lures of racial privilege and advantage, that they were vulnerable to whispers in the ear about not trusting each other, and that they had not built at a grassroots level a thick enough network of personal and interpersonal relationships that when they heard something disturbing, if a white person heard something disturbing about a black person, they didn't have somebody to go to find out about that. And conversely, when black people heard something disturbing about white people. And in that lack of interpersonal trust, they got pulled apart. And building that statue was a central part of establishing that mistrust and divided loyalty that would define, for the most part, the next half century.
So break down how they divided that. What did that look like strategy-wise as a historian?
Because it was a third-party movement, the leaders of both of the other main parties had an interest in destroying it. They were more devoted to maintaining a social class in power than they were into whether Democrats or Republicans were running the show. They could not have workers and workers organized interracially. They could not have that as an example. I stumbled across a minute book, the minutes of meetings, that the Knights of Labor Cooperative Building Society had in 1886 and 1887. The same time that this election was taking place. And the way the Cooperative Building Society worked is people paid dues. And every time the treasury reached $100, the organization had a lottery. And somebody got $100, which was enough money to buy a building lot in the city. African Americans as well as whites belonged to the Cooperative Building Society. Some people said, what if most of the dues payers are white? And when they pull a name out of the hat, it's a black guy who gets it. And what if he decides to buy a lot in a neighborhood that's been all white? And the Knights of Labor in their Cooperative Building Society said, we're all brothers in this organization. We don't care. We're going to have African Americans as well as whites, they got an equal chance to win, and they can choose to buy a lot wherever they want. So in the heart of the organization, that's pretty remarkable. And then there's all of this turbulence going on around them.
Yeah, the Working Man Reforms Party was built and they are now moving off of this momentum after building this beautiful city hall. How does the monument end up being built? Who builds it and who benefits, and what is that?
So the big advocates are the Daughters of the Confederacy, and they call on the state of Virginia to spend taxpayer money. That was part of the deal in 1890. They decide, unlike the city hall, which is built out of local materials by local workers, the statue was built in France and is imported to Richmond. Quite smart strategy. It comes in pieces. And so there's a whole elaborate process of lugging the pieces to the site, which had been a tobacco field worked by enslaved men and women, soon to become a suburb and a developed suburb. And it's lugged by rope up to this site and assembled. And 10,000 people get ecstatic over the christening of this monstrosity. And again, it's about the fight about history. And the narrative is, well, white people always loved Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee was always a representative of the white race. In fact, if Richmond was a center of the Underground Railroad, it wasn't only black folks. I want to mention, I have a friend, a great historian named Marcus Redeker. And Marcus writes a lot about sailors. And Marcus has written about what he calls the Maritime Underground Railroad and the way that ships in Norfolk and Richmond were used to help enslaved people escape. And he says, who was on those ships? Most of the sailors were white. Why were they helping these enslaved people to escape? Because they had a sense of class. They had a sense of the kind of tyranny that they worked under on these ships. Marcus tells the story, and I'm sorry that I'm forgetting the name of the enslaved person, because Marcus makes it a real point to mention him, but this was someone who escaped in 1847 and had no legs. His legs had been amputated. And Marcus asks, how can someone be a runaway slave who has no legs? And he was stowed away on a ship and carried to New Bedford, where he then was free. And then in the late 1850s, under the Fugitive Slave Law, he was arrested and returned to slavery. And I don't know if your listeners are familiar, Chelsea, with this wonderful new book about the woman, the enslaved woman, Oney Judge, who had been owned by George Washington, who escaped. The book is called Never Caught. And George Washington devoted decades to trying to capture her because it was a point of power that he had to show no one could escape from him. But Oney Judge did. And the owner of this legless enslaved person had to recapture him because they had to prove that escape and resistance were impossible. But the study of history shows us they were possible and they were present. Please go ahead.
So just for all you race capital listeners, we have actually had Dr. Erica Armstrong on the show. So visit.
Lucky you. Yeah.
So please visit Past History to learn a little bit more about George Washington and Martha Washington, which was the point of us showing that about the relentlessness of capturing this enslaved woman by other white women, as well as we lift Marsha Washington as another person on the women's monument that stands on the state capitol, as well as Sally Louise Thompson, who was a doctor for the Confederate Army that we are also now building a monument to. And as a reminder, yes, Richmond, Virginia is building another Confederate monument to a woman. Man. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
You're only going to find that information here on Race Capital. No one else is talking about it. Thank you so much for coming onto the show today. I already know that you will be a future guest again.
I look forward to it. Yeah.
And tell everybody again the name of your book and how they can find it.
Sure. So my book is called Black Labor in Richmond, 1865 to 1890. It was published in paperback by the University of Illinois Press. I urge you to patronize independent bookstores and resist the temptation to use Amazon.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you. Thank you. I look forward to lots more, Chelsea.
All right. We'll catch you soon.
You're tuned in to Race Capital on WRIRLP 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and you just heard an interview with Peter Radcliffe. Make sure you tune in to wherever you enjoy listening to podcasts to check the full interview with Peter. Stay tuned as we talk next to Bill Fletcher Jr. right here on Race Capital. Week, Race Capital is excited to welcome Bill Fletcher Jr., who is an acclaimed labor organizer and a writer. He's the author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Toward Social Justice, and also author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. We are so excited to welcome Bill Fletcher Jr. to the show.
I appreciate being on and being invited. I think Virginia is a very exciting state because of the transformation that's underway. And it's years of organizing that's taken place at multiple levels and increasingly electoral organization that's transforming the state. And I think that's very exciting. We're at a moment, we're at a very dangerous moment. And I think that what many people misunderstand is that Donald Trump is actually not on the ballot. A right-wing populist movement within which there's a significant neo-fascist constituency is on the ballot. And so if people are looking at it simply as a personality thing of Trump versus Biden, they're misunderstanding the moment that we're in. We're looking at, we have been fighting in many ways a defensive battle since the early 1970s, with constant pushbacks, erosion of our rights. And I think what's important about this moment are the possibilities. The mass upsurge that took place in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder was and is historic. This movement has to institutionalize its existence. One of the mistakes of my generation was believing that upsurges are permanent, and they're not. Upsurges decline. They're either routed or they decline on their own. And if you don't leave in its place organization on the ground, you'll be swept away. And I think that was a tremendous mistake. And I'm hoping that current activists in reviewing history get that and see the critical importance of organization, of winning political power, things like that.
Given the divide seen right here in Richmond organizing between electoral politics and grassroots organizing, I asked Bill Fletcher Jr. about this divide on the left.
Although electoral work and non-electoral organizing are complementary, it is frequently the case that people that are engaged in one believe that the other is in contradiction. And that's a mistake. That's a mistake that's very prevalent on the left. On the right, it's actually not. What's really interesting about the right wing is that they're far more flexible in understanding the way that electoral, non-electoral, legislative, litigation, all of that stuff is necessary in terms of building a movement. With us, we're purists. Most of the left is purists. And that's why we're getting our rear ends kicked. Because instead of understanding that we need to be walking with two legs, and that we've got to be operating on multiple levels, we think it is only one way or the other. And that is a strategic mistake. Really, at this point, we should know better, that we need to engage both.
Bill Fletcher Jr. then uses a little bit of the current labor organizing culture to describe a little bit of the struggle that we're seeing even right here in Richmond, Virginia.
Organized labor is a movement in crisis and has been in crisis. It's a movement that has faced what I've been arguing for years is a sort of strategic paralysis, that what is needed from organized labor ends up being something that challenges the paradigm within which organized labor has operated for years. And so this is something that a number of us have been chipping away at for years, to basically argue that organized labor needs to be truly a social justice movement and not just a movement for wages, hours, and working conditions. There's many people from organized labor that are very myopic. And you may be going to them because they're logical allies for various campaigns, and then they don't get it. That is, organized labor doesn't get it. Right. And that's one of the big challenges that we face right now.
It's been 100 years since the 19th Amendment was passed. Prior to being passed, there was an organizing struggle and divide where Black women were left behind by white suffragettes and Black men, both seeking the right to vote. So I asked Bill Fletcher Jr. about that context and how it applies to the divides of today.
Let me start with the 15th Amendment, then jump to the present. The battle over the 15th Amendment that led to the split that you mentioned really came down to whether or not the conditions existed in the 1860s to win the total victory, and whether or not the right to vote for Black men at that point, since men were the ones that were voting, was nevertheless going to be a significant victory. And I think what this comes down to is not looking at this question in abstract, but looking in the concrete in terms of what was going on at that moment in U.S. history. And this is why Frederick Douglass appealed to white suffragettes to support the 15th Amendment. But coming up to the present, what has been true in a large part of the 20th century that started to break down was throughout many, if not most, social movements, progressive social movements, the issue of male supremacy or patriarchy was something that women were repeatedly told to put on the back burner. And this was certainly the case in the Black Freedom Movement in the 60s. The movement was energized by Black women, but the leadership was overwhelmingly that of men. And the issues of male supremacy were backburned until there were revolts, the reverberations which we continue to feel, whether it was the role of people like Fannie Lou Hamer, or it was the articulation by the Combahee River Collective, or the Third World Women's Alliance. So we started to see this whole thing changing dramatically. The movement that we're up against right now, right-wing populism, the main face of that is white racism. But there's another face to it that is equally important, and that is the face of misogynism. I think the best way to describe it is that for right-wing populist movements, they tend to have mythical periods that they worship. I like to call it, say, that they see the future in the past. And for the right-wing populace, the 1950s is a critical period. And it's a critical period for a variety of reasons, including the increasing living standard of the average working person. But as far as they're concerned, men were men, women were girls, Black people knew their place, Latinos only existed to sell tacos, and Asians just sold Chinese food. So there was this sort of everyone knew their place. The right-wing populist movement that has emerged over, particularly since the 1970s, has made the attack on women, principally but not exclusively, through the anti-abortion movement, central to their vision. It's essentially trying to reaffirm the traditional patriarchal roles. Now, where it gets interesting and complicated and very sad is when you see that the right-wing populist movement is not just men, that significant numbers of white women will actively embrace patriarchy in the name of fighting for the white republic. And this is why our movement can't be simply an anti-racist movement, but really is a movement against oppression. And so while we want to clearly identify the centrality of racism in the current moment, we can't repeat the mistakes of the past of shoving these other issues under the table and to the back burner or whatever metaphor you'd like to use. And I think about this a lot because I study right-wing movements, and I am amazed at how these right-wing movements will frequently have women who are leading them. Le Pen in France, for example. Yet they're articulating a message that is fundamentally patriarchal. And they seem to see no inconsistency there. And they actually have a mass following.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In full Race Capital fashion, we couldn't let Bill Fletcher Jr. get off the line without asking him, what's his privilege and how does he use it to disrupt the myth of white supremacy? And in pure Bill Fletcher Jr. fashion,
he turned my question upside down.
I'm going to answer that question in a different way
Please.
Than you might be expecting. In the society, there is white racial privilege and there's male privilege. And I use the term privilege in a very specific way in order to emphasize that there is a system. It's not simply about what Bill Fletcher is thinking. There is a system of privilege, and what a privilege is, which is really a source of a lot of confusion out there. Privilege is synonymous with a differential in treatment. That white privilege is a differential in treatment that exists between the people who have been identified as white and others. Male privilege is a differential in treatment between those identified as men and others. It's not just something I make up in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, what do I do about that privilege, that system of privilege? So what I'll tell you what I don't do. I don't go into meetings and yell, I'm a man and I've got all this privilege. Because I have found that most regular people don't give a damn about that. What they want to know is, what am I actually doing to fight male supremacy? What am I doing to fight patriarchy? And if I'm just talking a lot, but I'm not doing anything, then it's worthless. And my attitude is the same towards white people. I don't need a white person coming into a meeting that started a meeting. And I see this all the time. I'm a white person. I want to acknowledge my privilege. I don't give a damn about that. I want to know, to what extent are you like John Brown or Ann Braden? That's all I want to know. So now, having said that, so I look at my job as, among other things, joining with others to fight male privilege. to fight various forms of discrimination, male supremacy, harassment, etc., that are targeted at women and targeted at non-gender binary groups, right? So that's the way I look at it. So it's not that I utilize my privilege. It's more that I'm fighting against a system of privilege.
Mm. Bill Fletcher Jr., how can people follow you and keep up with your work?
So my website is billfletcherjr.com, and Jr. is J-R. I'm also all over Facebook and Twitter. I'm the executive editor of a web magazine called globalafricanworker.com. And that's all one word, globalafricanworker.com. And what I want to say, in addition to thanking you for the honor of doing this program with you, is that people that are listening to this program need to keep in mind that we're in a marathon race. We're not in a sprint. One of the biggest mistakes for activists is to think that this is a quick run and to judge our success based on one victory or one defeat at a time. We've got to be looking down the road. And this is really hard. But if you don't, you'll burn out. If you don't, you'll become cynical.
A follow-up question to that. Not measuring by our wins, like political wins that way, are there ways to have a healthy measure of our wins?
Yeah. So I'd say several things. One is our wins. Mm-hmm. And another is the organizations that we build and sustain. Mm-hmm. The extent to which we root ourselves successfully among grassroots people, working class people, as opposed to just talking to ourselves. Mm-hmm. Our ability to influence so-called common sense, to borrow from Antonio Gramsci. In other words, our ability to influence what people take for granted. All of those things I just mentioned together, not separately, help us to see whether we're winning or whether we're losing. It's always the question of a tendency in one direction or the other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And hearing that, I will say, as an activist working right here in Richmond for a long time, that by those measurements, I think that we are winning. We are having growing organizations. And I know many activists are now having a chance to spread their work and amplify their work that really reach more people. Then that's the important part. And right. Really, I really appreciate that of what you say, because telling young folks that maybe are newer to this mobilization, politicalization, radicalization, and thinking mm-hmm. and learning so much so fast, even the information we just heard earlier this episode about how the monument came to be and that there was a whole third political party. This is coming so quickly. And even though the specific demands that were printed on our posters may not have been met by the politicians, there has been great progress made in the unity and the mutual aid and the support and care and truly just the connections that we now have with one another.
Excellent.
Thank you so much.
All right. Keep the faith.
And that concludes this week's episode of Race Capital. Thanks so much to our guests, Dr. Peter Radcliffe and Bill Fletcher Jr. Thanks as always to my co-host, Kalia Harris and Naomi Isaac. And thanks to you, Race Capital listeners. If you've enjoyed this episode, make sure you're subscribed wherever you listen to your podcast. And consider joining our Patreon to support our sustainable work as we pump out weekly episodes, continue to interrogate the racial narratives from our place, space, and time, right here in the fallen capital of the Confederacy, Richmond, Virginia. We'll catch you next week, right here at 10 a.m. on WRIR-LP 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. I'm Chelsea Hicks Wise. Thanks for tuning in.
In a vision of my mind, I remember when she said to me, don't ever look behind. She said, look ahead, and I would see someone always loving me. Her picture is painted in my memory. Without a color of despair, no matter where I go, black is the color of my true love's hair.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, ghosts and goblins are going door to door to gather up candy. But did you know that some of that candy is made by union workers? In Hershey, Pennsylvania, tagged the sweetest place on earth, you'll find the nation's chocolate center. It wasn't always so sweet for workers, though, who in 1937 tried to win union recognition. Then the company laid off some of the union organizers, claiming it was due to seasonal cutbacks. Outraged, 600 workers began a sit-down strike in the plant. Local dairy farmers, relying on Hershey to purchase their milk, grew increasingly angry at the strikers. They joined with workers not participating in the strike and other community members. The angry mob stormed the plant to oust the strikers. 25 strikers were severely beaten, and the sit-down strike ended. But the next year, the Hershey workers tried again to form a union. This time, they affiliated with the Bakery and Confectionery Workers International Union of America and established Local 464. They are not the only union members who help make Halloween sweet. Today, Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco, and Grain Millers Union Local 1 in Chicago, Illinois makes Tootsie Rolls. If your candy of choice is Clark Bar or Thin Mints, you might want to thank the members of Local 348 in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Local 125 makes Ghirardelli Chocolate in San Francisco. Unfortunately, things are not always so sweet. In September of 2016, 400 workers at the Just Born Candy Factory in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, went out on strike. The company decided to change their pensions to a 401k for new hires and reduce healthcare contributions. They make such iconic candies as Peeps, Mike and Ike's, and Hot Tamales. One strike slogan rang out, "No pensions, no Peeps."
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. Organizing Through the Divide was originally broadcast on Race Capital, a weekly one-hour show that airs on Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. Race Capital was created by Chelsea Higgs Wise. You'll find it wherever you listen to podcasts, or check out our website at chelseahiggswise.com/racecapital. You can subscribe to Labor History Today on your favorite podcast app, and even better, you can like it in your podcast app and pass it along. You can be part of Labor History Today by reading a labor history item. Just shoot us a note, laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. Our music today was Freedom Ride by the R.J. Phillips Band, a Baltimore-based band led by retired history teacher Joe DiFilippo. At the top, we heard An OK Song About Robert E. Lee by Paparazzi and the Fatogs. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices, broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to more than 70 labor radio and podcast shows. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy. But do keep making history. Don't forget to vote. And see you next time.
hearts are bleeding.
We won't stop.